his way through the papers. As he made his way through the salmon-pink broadsheet of the Financial Times, an op-ed column caught his eye. "Time to take on Pakistan's jihadist spies," read the headline. It was by an acquaintance of his named Mansoor Ijaz. A week after U.S. Special Forces stormed the hideout of Osama bin Laden and killed him, the column began, a senior Pakistani diplomat telephoned me with an urgent request. Ijaz claimed that the diplomat wanted to pass a message from Pakistan's president, Zardari, to Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, without the ISI finding out. The embarrassment of bin Laden being found on Pakistani soil had humiliated Mr. Zardari's weak civilian government to such an extent that the president feared a military takeover was imminent, Ijaz wrote. He needed an American fist on his army chief's desk to end any misguided notions of a coup, and fast. Ijaz claimed that he drafted a memo according to the diplomat's specifications over the course of a series of phone calls. Its request? That the United States order Pakistan's army chief, General Kayani, to stand down the Pakistani military intelligence establishment. There was more. President Zardari was supposedly assembling a new national security team to take power and eliminate hardline elements within the ISI. Whatever its provenance, Ijaz did write a memo and sent it to recently departed National Security Advisor Jim Jones, who passed it to Mullen. The Raymond Davis incident and the bin Laden raid had revived whispers about Haqqani's loyalties. The previous year, he had been responsible for unstopping the flow of visas. Now, as stories of uninvited spies and Navy SEALs roiled Pakistan, fingers pointed at him. "One of the things that the ISI held against me was that the people on the ground who had helped on the raid had probably been given visas by me behind their back," Haqqani told me. "That's how they thought, because they are so conspiratorial." The narrative favored by the conspiracy theorists, that Haqqani colluded with the Americans to let in a secret network of spies, continues to have life in Pakistan. In March 2017, a copy of a letter from the Prime Minister's office authorizing Haqqani to issue visas without notifying Islamabad surfaced in the press, giving credence to Haqqani's claim that he wasn't acting unilaterally. But that was swiftly followed by another leak, this time of a letter from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs allegedly warning Haqqani not to approve visas for CIA agents. In the eyes of some in the military establishment, Haqqani was a turncoat, the man who had opened up Pakistan's borders to the interlopers. Haqqani realized how the Financial Times op-ed would look to anyone with that view. It was hard to think of another senior Pakistani diplomat who so closely fit the pro-civilian, pro-American ideology described in the memo. When he got to the bottom of the column, Haqqani picked up his BlackBerry for the first time that morning and called Mansoor Ijaz on his London area code cell phone. "What's happening?" Haqqani asked. "You're not the only Pakistani official I know," Ijaz replied as both men remembered the conversation. Haqqani said that Ijaz laughed as he said it. "This could provoke some sort of political crisis," Haqqani said, less amused. "Nah, I don't think that's going to happen," Ijaz said, according to Haqqani's recollection. "The rest of the article's more important." Haqqani shook his head at the memory. "The man was completely out of his depth," he told me. Ijaz said there was another beat in the conversation, Haqqani telling him, shortly before hanging up, "You have just killed me." Mansoor Ijaz was on his yacht when, according to his telling, he got the call from Hussein Haqqani and flew into action to draft the memo. Ijaz had the biography of a supporting character in an Agatha Christie novel. Perhaps he planned it that way. A Pakistani-American businessman who made his fortune as a hedge fund manager, he flitted around the French Riviera. He emphasized his rags-to-riches story when talking to the press. He was born in Florida, raised on a farm in Floyd County, Virginia, covered his tuition at UVA through a weightlifting scholarship. He gave plenty of attention to the riches part, too. "God gave me so much in this world, but if all I left in the world was a jet on the runway, a yacht in the harbor, 10 homes around the world, and my wife's 5,000 pairs of shoes, I will not have done my job," he told the Washington Post during the scandal. Ijaz's father told him, "God gave you a great brain, but a shit personality. You have to get into politics to teach you humility." When Ijaz hit pay dirt in finance, He began donating hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Democrats and built up as many contacts as possible. He wrote op-eds. He started projecting himself into international conflicts. In the 1990s, he approached the Clinton administration saying he was negotiating with Sudan to secure the arrest of Osama bin Laden, who was sheltering there at the time. Clinton officials dismissed him as a Walter Mitty type, living out a personal fantasy, according to one report. Later, he surfaced as a Fox News commentator and made sensational claims that radical Iranian mullahs were smuggling chemical weapons into Iraq. He later admitted this was erroneous. A string of assertions, on air and in op-eds, was similarly colorful and suspect. But none had precipitated an international incident like this latest claim. A few days after the Financial Times op-ed ran, the first items began appearing in the Pakistani press. Zardari had made a deal with the devil, critics crowed. The civilian government was in cahoots with the Americans. Haqqani got a call from President Zardari. What happened? The army is taking this seriously. Haqqani, not explicitly named in the initial op-ed, became a fixture in subsequent coverage after the politician Imran Khan named him as the culprit. The ISI launched an investigation, with General Pasha rendezvousing with Ijaz in London and downloading evidence from his BlackBerry. Logs of his calls and messages later presented in court showed a flurry of exchanges between the two men, though the calls were brief and the messages often came from Ijaz, not Haqqani. Haqqani said he was the victim of his own politeness and that perfunctory, thank you very much for sending messages were being used against him. 2 months after the op-ed ran, Zardari called again and ordered Haqqani back to Pakistan, where the ISI and the public wanted blood. Haqqani fielded a flurry of warning calls from Americans. Holbrooke's successor, Mark Grossman, one of Doug Lutz's staffers, Deputy CIA Director Mike Morrell. Don't go, Haqqani remembered Morrell saying. The boys at the ISI have it in for you. Haqqani was already boarding a flight to Doha, en route to Islamabad. I had struggled too long for civilian government to let it fall on the basis of a false allegation against me, he said. I wasn't going to let the military topple the elected government. He told his wife and kids that, if he didn't return, it would be because he paid the ultimate price for his beliefs. On his flight, they were playing a film about Harry Houdini. Haqqani decided this would be his frame of reference for his final showdown with the ISI. They can tie me up, they can do anything. I'll be Houdini and get out of it. Screw that. I'm going. On arrival, Haqqani's passport was confiscated and he was whisked to the president's palace, where Zardari had guaranteed his safety. He had packed 3 days of clothes. He ended up being there for more than 2 months. Khayani and Pasha, the all-powerful heads of Pakistan's army and intelligence agency, questioned him. What do you say to all of this? Said Khayani. It's all nonsense, Haqqani replied. He had Admiral Mullen on speed dial, he pointed out. Why would he use a businessman in the Riviera as a go-between? Haqqani's exchange with Khayani and Pasha was gleefully rendered by the media as a multi-hour interrogation. What the fuck, I'm here, Haqqani muttered to himself, watching the gruesome reports. But as the months wore on, he grew more worried. His case was handed not to the parliament, which had pro-civilian voices, but to the Supreme Court, which was under the military's thumb. The court issued a travel ban. At one point, Zardari suffered a stroke and was flown to Dubai. His protector gone, Haqqani was moved to the Prime Minister's house, which is guarded by the army. In the middle of the night, he heard shuffling boots and thought, for a moment, that they might have finally decided to take him out. It turned out to be a routine changing of the guard. His anxiety peaked when, one Friday night in late January, the Supreme Court announced a sudden hearing for the following Monday. Hearings were never announced at night. There was a knock at the door. A businessman, whom Haqqani and others involved declined to name, gave him instructions. The Supreme Court would open briefly in the morning, despite it being a Saturday. Haqqani was to file an application to leave the country. Then he was to depart immediately, before the hearing. With Haqqani gone, the court proceeded ex parte, issuing a report based only on the testimony of Ijaz, who continued to point the finger at Haqqani. In an allegation later revived by Pakistani authorities in 2018, Haqqani was also accused of paying off Americans using a Pakistani slush fund and failing to report back home on the particulars. But since Haqqani wasn't present, there was no formal legal judgment. It was classic Pakistani political theater. The military and intelligence powers got the optics of acting against an American stooge without any of the consequences. Haqqani had his suspicions that Ijaz may have cooked up the memo at the behest of the ISI, but he conceded it was more likely that a serial fantasist got in over his head, and the ISI and the military seized the opportunity to eliminate an enemy. Mansour Ijaz maintained that Haqqani had dictated the memo to him, but otherwise declined to comment. "There are material inaccuracies in this recantation," he said of Haqqani's version of events. "Too many, I'm afraid, to take a lot of time to fix them." A few years later, I caught up with Haqqani in his small office at the Hudson Institute, the conservative think tank. A narrow window overlooked gray buildings on Pennsylvania Avenue. On the walls hung photographs of Haqqani shaking hands with George W. Bush and Barack Obama. In one picture, he was arm in arm with Richard Holbrook. Haqqani sat at a table stacked with loose paper. It was 2017, and he was in a familiar position, under fire in the Pakistani press. In a Washington Post op-ed, he had defended Donald Trump's contacts with the Russians, comparing them to his own entrees to the Obama administration. He suggested his outreach during Obama's transition later helped the United States stage the bin Laden raid. It was true, indirectly. It ultimately fell to him to approve visas for Joint Special Operations Commander Admiral McRaven and others involved in planning the operation. By the time the column reached Pakistan, it had been inflated into a long-awaited confirmation that Hussein Haqqani built a network of CIA agents right under his boss's noses. The veracity of concerns about his role in the entire issue also stands confirmed, read a gleeful tweet from a Pakistan Army spokesperson. In a sense, Haqqani had chosen this life as a pariah. But he never stopped wishing his homeland would understand his belief in dialogue and his skepticism of a bilateral relationship built on transactions between generals. He handed me one document after another, chronicling in minute detail the Memogate controversy, which still loomed large in his imagination. Wearing a loose gray suit and a cyan tie dusted with white tridents, he looked tired. "Look, it's taken an adjustment," he said heavily. "In the view of many people in Pakistan, I'm not a patriot." "You've spent your whole life working for your government," I said. "That must be painful." "Yeah, for my country, for democracy in my country, so it hurts me." He still wondered if he should go back, but he always had second thoughts. "What if someone really thinks I am a traitor and shoots me?" he pondered. Exile was bittersweet. Haqqani survived, but his life's work, his fight to transform the relationship between the two countries, to build something more sustainable and less transactional, was done. In his final conversation with Richard Holbrooke at the Four Seasons, both men had pledged to keep going in their respective fights against entrenched military thinking until they couldn't. A year after Holbrooke's fight ended, so did Haqqani's. Chapter 16. The Real Thing. That awful day in 2014, Robin Rafel stood on her porch and stared at the warrant and the espionage statute listed on it. The two young FBI agents looked at her. One asked, "Do you know any foreigners?" Rafel goggled. "1,000, she said. "I'm a diplomat." The agents asked her about Pakistanis. She named Hussein Haqqani and his successor as ambassador to the United States, Jalil Abbas Jilani. The agents glanced at each other. "Do you have any classified material in the house?" the other agent pressed on. "No," said Rafel. "Of course not." They handed her several State Department cables marked classified and dated back to her time as assistant secretary. They'd found them in a filing cabinet in Rafel's basement. Rafel smacked a palm to her forehead, remembering the moment later. Cleaning out her office years before, she had taken a number of items home and neglected to remove the cables. "They shouldn't have been there," she was quick to admit. "But it was just a case of me, when I left the office, not having the time to kind of look through everything." She knew dozens of prominent officials with worse habits. We all did. As the agent's questioning grew more intense, Rafel tried to convince them there'd been a misunderstanding. I mean, I was just such an idiot, complete idiot, because I thought, oh, I can just explain. It was nearly 2 hours before she realized she needed a lawyer. She called one she knew, a government contracts specialist she met while lobbying at Cassidy & Associates. A few hours later, she and her daughter Alexandra sat at DiCarlo's, a nearby Italian restaurant with breadsticks on the tables and faded green carpeting that her kids had always called a mafioso spot. It was a frequent meeting place for CIA agents, according to neighborhood lore. They were joined by two lawyers, the one she'd called and a younger associate who'd raced over in an Uber to get there more quickly. Alexandra, a short, feisty redhead, was distraught. "How could you possibly have documents in the house?" she wailed. "What were you thinking?" Rafel tried to process what had happened. She ordered a glass of wine. "The truth is, I was in shock," she later told me. "In medical terms." The next day, diplomatic security arrived at the house to confiscate her BlackBerry and work ID. She was summoned by State Department Human Resources and informed that her security clearance was suspended, and her contract, which was up for renewal, would be allowed to lapse. It was the first time she had walked into state without department ID in years. When the guard at the C Street entrance saw the name on her driver's license, Rafel recalled him trembling visibly. Days later, the story hit the front page of the New York Times. FBI is investigating retired U.S. diplomat. A State Department spokesperson told reporters only that the department was cooperating with law enforcement. Ms. Rafel's appointment expired, the spokesperson added. She is no longer a department employee. Robin Rafel was never allowed back into her office. FBI agents scoured her desk, then sealed the doors. A few weeks earlier, Rafel had arrived in Islamabad with a mission from Dan Feldman, from whom Holbrook had jokingly requested a heart, and who had recently assumed the Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan job. Protesters were taking to the streets across Pakistan, railing against alleged vote rigging that, in 2013, propelled Nawaz Sharif back into power. Some commentators argued that a soft coup was underway, with Sharif quietly surrendering control to the military. Robin Rafel, with her peerless Rolodex in Islamabad, was there to ferret out information on whether the government would actually fall. She set to work, attending dinner parties and making notes about gossip she heard, which she reported back to Feldman and the ambassador in Islamabad, Richard Olson. What she was doing, Olson told me, was diplomacy. In the 3 years since the annus horribilis of 2011, the relationship between the countries had remained icy. Colleagues at state viewed Rafel as a vanishing asset, someone the Pakistanis still talked to. She had no way of knowing that her every move during that trip to Islamabad was being watched by the FBI. Rafel's brand of old-school diplomacy was struggling to find purchase alongside not only the military domination of foreign policy, but also the surveillance state that had evolved since 9/11. Face-to-face conversations had been steadily eclipsed by signals intelligence or intercepted communications. In early 2013, NSA analysts listening in on Pakistani politicians' phone calls began to focus on an American in the conversations, Robin Rafel. She seemed to be discussing sensitive matters, drone strikes, coups. They sent an 811 referral, indicating suspected chatter about classified material, to the FBI. The two agents Rafel later met on her porch were selected to lead the investigation for their focus on 65 work, spy cases. They began to look at Rafel's contacts, her personnel files at the State Department, her personal life. After a few months, they obtained a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court warrant to monitor her Skypes and calls with Pakistani officials. It had been a year since Edward Snowden's whistleblowing, and the Bureau was looking for moles and leakers. With Rafel, they hoped they'd hit pay dirt. Her background seemed to have all the hallmarks. Decades spent largely abroad, her status as a registered lobbyist, her brazen sympathies with dubious Pakistan of all places. "Oh, totally," she told me when I asked if she felt that sentiment prejudiced the investigation. "Everybody hated Pakistan, so of course." The Pakistanis she spoke with sometimes went on to refer to her as a source and tout how informative she'd been. And digging revealed further flags, She'd been cited for a handful of minor infractions related to the handling of classified material, leaving documents out or computers unlocked. And then there were the documents in the filing cabinet in her basement, which could carry a criminal charge separate from the more serious espionage charges. But the FBI investigation also flowed from multiple layers of misunderstanding. The intelligence and law enforcement agencies searching for moles had little knowledge of the peculiar rituals of diplomacy in Pakistan. Anyone who had ever spent 5 minutes at a dinner party in Islamabad knew that the nominally classified topics Rafal had been discussing, like drone strikes, were an unavoidable matter of public debate. Bragging about Americans being sources of information was, similarly, a typically Pakistani expression of bravado. Rafal was also up against a more general kind of confusion. The old-fashioned schmoozing and relationship building she had built her career around was out of vogue and foreign for a generation raised in the surveillance age. Holbrook's SRAP team, which she had joined, with its interagency staff all aimed at broadening rather than narrowing the conversations in the region, was particularly out of step with the times. People didn't understand the SRAP office, which I'm sure doesn't surprise you, Rafal recalled. They didn't understand the bureaucratic structure. Who were all these people? Who did they report to? What were they doing there? What was their scope of work? The value of all this talk wasn't self-evident. How could it be? In places like Pakistan, conversation had long been an afterthought to the business of generals and spies. One evening, about a week before Donald Trump's inauguration in 2017, Robin Rafal came in from the Washington, D.C. winter and took off her coat. We were at Garden Cafe, a quiet bistro around the corner from the State Department with peach walls decorated with bland paintings of flowers. Jazz played faintly. As always, her personal style reflected her years in Pakistan. She wore a taupe pashmina with silver embroidery thrown over one shoulder of a gray jacket, and her blonde hair was swept into a French twist. She ordered a Sauvignon Blanc. I look back on it now and I see the humor in it, she said, with a tone that suggested she didn't see the humor in it at all. But it was, you know, any way you slice it, it is profoundly wrong to do that to somebody. She seemed unchanged, lips tightly pursed, chin held high, the same haughty delivery. But in fact, just about everything had changed for Robin Rafal. As the FBI dug deeper, their case lost steam. Circling Rafal over the course of months, investigators had avoided talking to her co-workers at the State Department, not wanting to tip her off and lose a chance to catch her in the act. Once they began speaking with officials familiar with her work, they started to understand that Rafal's incriminating behavior was in fact simply old-school, relationship-driven diplomacy. In early 2015, the U.S. Attorney's Office overseeing the case told Rafal's lawyer that it was dropping the espionage charges. Prosecutors still seemed to want to extract something to save face, like a plea in the lesser charge related to the classified material. Rafal wouldn't budge. She knew those infractions were common and not grounds for significant criminal proceedings. In March 2016, prosecutors finally dropped the case entirely. It had been 17 months since the raid on her house. She had spent more than $100,000 in legal fees. Friends banded together to help cover them, but she was still decimated financially and out of a job. I haven't worked in 2 years, she told me, and I have significant responsibility still for my children and legal bills and stuff like that. She laughed coldly. It's just beyond imagination that you spend 40 years working hard, and this is what happens. She was looking for work, but the cloud of suspicion made it difficult. Nobody's going to hire you when the FBI has accused you of being a spy on the front page of the New York Times, above the fold. The investigation's announcement was a circus. Its resolution barely registered a blip. Later, she took odd consulting jobs, part-time. Anything she could find to make ends meet. Life on the outside was hard to adjust to. Rafal's work had, for as long as she could remember, been her life. I'm a working woman, she said. I'm not a homemaker. I mean, I can cook and do various things, but I've never been a homebody. She struggled to hold on to some semblance of her old world. Every day, she woke up early, sat at her dining room table in front of an aging laptop, and put out feelers for work. She advised non-governmental groups on the subject of reconciliation in Afghanistan, a project the United States government had once again left for dead. She read copiously, especially about politics and Pakistan. She went to every think tank and foreign policy event she could, especially anything about South Asia. In early 2016, I interviewed Pakistani filmmaker Sharmeen Obaid Chinoy about her documentary on honor killings in front of a small audience at the United States Institute of Peace. There was Robin Rafel in the front row, taking notes. A few attendees glanced at her curiously and exchanged whispers. Her family had to adjust. Alexandra continued to feel mortified. It was a real body blow to her, Rafel said. She was engaged to be married, and explaining the scandal to her in-laws became a family crisis. She was afraid people wouldn't come to the wedding, that everyone would be thinking about this embarrassing thing, she recalled. Rafel took the bus to New York and met with the bridegroom's parents, a successful investment banker, and his polished, yoga-going wife. I'm not a spy, she told them. Oh, they replied. That night at the Garden Cafe, Rafel raked her red lacquered nails across the white tablecloth with a snick sound. If anybody put these guys onto this, she said, it would have been an American. An American who felt you were too close, I said. Yep. And you know, she said under her breath, leaning in conspiratorially, the intelligence community is chock full of Indian Americans who have a huge chip on their shoulder about Pakistan. They're there for their language skills. You see these people coming in from INR, the State Department Intelligence Bureau, to brief, and they're clueless. They have an attitude. They don't know anything. She leaned back and picked up her Sauvignon Blanc with a slosh. I spoke with more than a dozen of Rafel's colleagues about the investigation. None thought she was a spy. Several questioned her coziness with a treacherous regime. The term clientitis sometimes came up. Robin Rafel was a loyal, even patriotic, American public servant. But she had internalized Pakistani attitudes, right down to the tendency to blame India, even Americans of Indian descent. Rafel's approach was imperfect. Unlike Richard Holbrook, who used diplomacy to transform the strategic orientation of the relationships he tackled, she followed the rules. She used diplomacy to maintain the status quo. And for decades, the status quo in Pakistan had been holding things together just enough for military and intelligence cooperation to continue. Sometimes that could look like appeasement. Empowered diplomacy, used as a frontline tool as Richard Holbrooke had urged, might have looked very different. But Rafel was a believer in an old-fashioned diplomatic maxim. You never stop talking. Dating back to her advocacy for the Taliban, she had been an extreme embodiment of that ethos. Now, in an era where diplomacy of any kind was being sidelined in America's most sensitive relationships, that behavior was more than unusual. It even looked criminal. She was trying to work on the U.S. national interests, doing things we all thought were important, one senior official told me, on condition of anonymity since the investigation was still a sore point with law enforcement. And by doing that, she looked to someone like a spy. The danger of the whole thing was criminalizing diplomacy. When the Wall Street Journal profiled the Rafel case, it headlined the resulting article, "The Last Diplomat." As Rafel rose from our table, she shook her head at the characterization. Ronan, can we please get this straight? I have had foreign policy people come up and say, you were doing the old-fashioned thing, and now there's a new thing. She fixed her blue eyes on me. I wasn't doing the wrong thing. I wasn't doing the out-of-date thing. I was doing the real thing. Robin Rafel pulled on her coat and stepped back out into the cold. Part 2. Shoot first. Ask questions never. Syria, 2016. Afghanistan, 2002. The Horn of Africa, 2006. Egypt, 2013. Colombia, 2006. Do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. 1 Corinthians 15:33. Chapter 17. General Rule. 7 years after Richard Holbrooke died, I walked by the front door of what had once been the office of the Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. The hospital white paint job on the wall was the same, and the wooden door with the honey-colored stain. The sign was new. Special Presidential Envoy for the Global Coalition to Counter ISIL, it read. The SRAP team, and Holbrooke's dream of negotiating with the Taliban, had been quietly shuttered over the course of Donald Trump's first year in office, and its last employees let go. In the first days of 2018, Trump's first Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, told me he hadn't yet made a final decision on the office's future, but it was obvious that he didn't think much of it. "Whether we need an SRAP or not, we're considering that," he said. Tillerson argued that the conventional roles responsible for Afghanistan and Pakistan, the ambassadors to those countries and the assistant secretary for South and Central Asia, were much better than an SRAP, much better. But by early 2018, the South and Central Asia Bureau still didn't have a permanent assistant secretary. If someone was actively championing diplomatic solutions for the region, it wasn't apparent. The fears of militarization Holbrooke had expressed in his final, desperate memos had come to pass on a scale he could have never anticipated. President Trump had concentrated ever more power in the Pentagon, granting it nearly unilateral authority in areas of policy once orchestrated across multiple agencies, including the State Department. In Iraq and Syria, the White House quietly delegated more decisions on troop deployments to the military. In Yemen and Somalia, field commanders were given authority to launch raids without White House approval. In Afghanistan, Trump granted the Secretary of Defense, General James Mattis, sweeping authority to set troop levels. In public statements, the White House downplayed the move, saying the Pentagon still had to adhere to the broad strokes of policies set by the White House. But in practice, the fate of thousands of troops in a diplomatic tinderbox of a conflict had, for the first time in recent history, been placed solely in military hands. Diplomats were no longer losing the argument on Afghanistan. They weren't in it. In early 2018, the military began publicly rolling out a new surge. In the following months, up to 1,000 new troops would join the 14,000 already in place. Back home, the White House itself was crowded with military voices. A few months into the Trump administration, at least 10 of 25 senior leadership positions on the president's National Security Council were held by current or retired military officials. As the churn of firings and hirings continued, that number grew to include the White House Chief of Staff, a position given to former General John Kelly. At the same time, the White House ended the practice of detailing State Department officers to the National Security Council. There would now be fewer diplomatic voices in the policy process, by design. America's relationships around the world, too, took on a distinctly military flavor. In early 2018, the Trump administration leaked its plans for a Buy American strategy that would give State Department diplomats around the world a new mandate, drumming up arms sales for defense contractors. American arms sales had already been climbing over the preceding 5 years. But a spate of new deals under the Trump administration suggested a widening gulf between such sales and any diplomacy that might provide context and direction for them. During a diplomatic crisis between Qatar and other Gulf states in 2017, as Trump excoriated the Qatari government for its ties to terrorists, the Pentagon announced it was selling $12 billion in F-15 fighters to the nation. Secretary of Defense Mattis met with his counterpart, the Qatari defense minister, to seal the deal. State Department officials were barely involved, according to several Pentagon staffers. Military exigencies trumped concerns that had been obstacles to such deals in prior administrations. In the midst of a human rights crackdown in Bahrain, including murder and torture by government forces, the State Department announced that it would resume the sale of F-16 fighter jets to that country's monarchy without any attendant human rights conditions. At the State Department in late May 2017, a reporter asked Acting Assistant Secretary of State Stuart E. Jones, a career Foreign Service officer in a post to which no permanent appointee had been nominated, how the administration reconciled a record-setting $110 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia with that regime's abysmal human rights record. Jones sighed heavily. He muttered, glancing around, knitting and re-knitting his fingers. Then he froze for 20 seconds, his face slackened into a 1,000-yard stare. He offered a few halting sentences about fighting extremism, and another interminable pause before hurrying off stage, head down, like he'd realized he was naked in a dream. Again and again, President Trump called authoritarian strongmen to sing their praises. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi of Egypt, as he presided over one of the worst human rights crackdowns in the country's history, was fantastic, and we are very much behind him. The Philippines' Rodrigo Duterte, who admitted to murdering opponents and cheerfully encouraged his troops to rape women, was doing an unbelievable and great job. Trump personally invited both to the White House, breaking with the previous administration. Of all the living former secretaries of state, only one, James Baker, wholeheartedly endorsed the closer rapport. Egypt, the Philippines, and Turkey are all historic partners of the United States, and it is important that we deal with those leaders, Baker said. An observation often attributed to President Franklin D. Roosevelt puts this phenomenon in the proper perspective. He may be an SOB, President Roosevelt said of a Latin American dictator, but he's our SOB. John Kerry evinced a more typical perspective. I don't understand, he said, what this president aims to achieve by going so far as to hold up as positives or describe as strong things which violate international norms and certainly are unprecedented coming out of the mouth of an American president of any party. The diplomats once charged with managing these delicate relationships were as surprised as anyone. Repeatedly, they weren't informed. If anyone's seen the increasing militarization of foreign policy, it's definitely me, said Chris Levine, a career official who had been one of Holbrooke's special assistants on the SRAP team and was working on Syria policy at State when news of the cuts and firings hit. Stationed in a series of assignments focused on the Islamic State, he witnessed two dynamics that helped to plunge America's Syria policy into chaos. The first was inside the State Department. The new sign on what was once Holbrooke's door was not incidental. Counter-ISIL activities had become a whirlpool, pulling in more and more of the department's resources and activities. Brett McGurk, the special envoy on combating ISIL, had become one of the most powerful officials in the building. The second change had come from outside. The department had yielded more and more of its power to the military. We ceded a lot of policy ground to the folks doing counter-ISIL, in the Pentagon, in Tampa, and in the building at State, he said, referring to the Pentagon's Central Command headquarters in Florida, CENTCOM. Hard underlying parts of the diplomacy were absolutely ceded, and progress on other policy issues, such as human rights concerns, economics, and the bilateral relationship with Turkey, were largely sacrificed. With no centralized dialogue led by diplomats, and the White House, beginning with Obama and continuing under Trump, vacillating between different half-measures, the CIA and the Pentagon essentially built the United States Syria policy. This proved problematic as the two agencies set about creating separate and sometimes conflicting relationships with forces on the ground. The CIA covertly armed and trained the loose coalition of so-called moderate rebels in the Free Syrian Army, FSA. The Pentagon set up and began arming a coalition called the Syrian Democratic Forces, dominated by the Kurdish YPG. Yekyinyein Perestina Gel, or People's Protection Units. Both relationships proved problematic. FSA arms ended up in the hands of terrorist groups like Jabhat al-Nusra, and the YPG was inextricably entwined with the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, Partia Karkaran Kurdistani, a revolutionary group labeled a terrorist organization by the United States. They play shell games with their organization's names, said Levine. These guys are one and the same as PKK. The Pentagon's unbridled relationship with the YPG also presented a further wrinkle. The Kurds are the mortal enemy of the Turks. Due to our singular focus on eliminating the immediate threat of ISIL, we've exacerbated a 35-year conflict between Turkish security forces and the PKK, which is likely to rage for much longer, he continued. From the barrel-bombed husk that was once the city of Aleppo, an FSA commander named Abdullah al-Musa was more blunt. American policy with the SDF will make a civil war in the future between Arabs and Kurds. The U.S. do a very big mistake. That very big mistake was already apparent on the ground. At several times, the Kurds, Turks, and Syrian rebels were all locked in battle, all undergirded by the United States arms and air support. One hot, summery Saturday in August 2016, rockets hit two Turkish tanks in northern Syria, killing one of Turkey's soldiers and unraveling a delicate web of alliances for the United States. Turkey quickly blamed the YPG and struck back hard, killing 25 Kurdish YPG fighters the next day, according to Turkish state-run media, in addition to 20 civilians. The FSA announced the capture of 10 Kurdish villages the same day. Videos circulated online showed U.S.-backed FSA fighters brutally beating U.S.-backed YPG soldiers. A month later, Abdullah El-Musa, the FSA commander, sheltered in an encampment outside of Aleppo, the shelling audible even through his closed windows, even late at night. "It's really a chaos," he said. "When the United States is supporting those groups like the Kurd groups, which don't fight Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and just want to make their country, it's really a very big mistake." Unsurprisingly, he viewed his own FSA forces as a more suitable partner, though he conceded fighting the Syrian regime was his first concern, before combating ISIL at the behest of the United States. Free Syrian Army lawyer Osama Abu Zaid said the United States' presence in the Syrian conflict inspired confusion, with the CIA backing the FSA and the Pentagon backing the SDF and its Kurdish subsidiaries. "There is no direct communication between Pentagon and Free Syrian Army," he said. "The divisions between U.S. agencies led to strange situations within joint command and training centers, with Pentagon officials refusing to talk to confused FSA commanders being armed by the CIA. Abu Zaid said sometimes the Americans seemed to relish the tension. Sometimes the CIA people here, they were happy because the Pentagon program is false." This was what tactics without strategy looked like. Deadly farce. During the first half of 2017, the Trump administration chose its side, first reauthorizing Pentagon support for the Kurds over the objections of the Turks, then shutting down the CIA's covert support for rebel elements. The Pentagon seizing control effectively shut the State Department out of what should have been an important mandate, maintaining relations with Turkey, a necessary but difficult regional ally. Military proxy wars replacing diplomacy in the region had been completely corrosive from a strategic standpoint, said Levine. "I worked on managing the Turkey relationship, and the U.S. arming the YPG so overtly has competed with and eroded our bilateral relationship. Turkey perceives the YPG as we would if they were based in Texas and arming the Sinaloa cartel." It undercuts civilian efforts to talk to the Turks on a range of issues. "We had to restrain ourselves on issues of mutual concern we should have been able to address. Human rights in Turkey, the clamping down on civil society and mass purges related to the July 2016 coup attempt, and making progress on bilateral issues with a NATO ally," Levine added. "Instead, cooperating with the Syrian Kurds dominated the conversation and limited our ability to conduct diplomacy." Hillary Clinton bridled at the suggestion that she had ever been absent from policymaking on Syria. She had backed her military and intelligence counterparts' case for more muscular intervention. "I thought we needed to do more to support the legitimate opposition to Bashar al-Assad," she explained. "I got the CIA and the Defense Department on board with that." But at a working level, multiple officials said the State Department had surrendered so much power that there was little counterbalance from civilian voices, at least those who didn't fall into lockstep with the requests of the Pentagon or Langley. "You have mostly mil-mil contacts at this point," said Levine. "This is the Pentagon talking to their counterparts. State felt like the fourth or fifth most important agency in foreign policy." And back on Mahogany Row, there was no alternative perspective left. The most powerful voices in the building were aligned with the commanders prosecuting the counter-ISIL campaign at the expense of the longer-term U.S. foreign policy objectives in the region. For State, it's become impossible to have an honest policy disagreement with the uniform, or you risk being sidelined from the discussion at all. Levine, a kid from Brooklyn who witnessed September 11th and wanted to serve, had initially intended to leave State in 2010, after his Afghanistan and Pakistan assignment ended. He'd remained there after promising Holbrooke, not long before his death, that he'd stay to fight another day. Levine left amid the budget cuts and firings in mid-2017, after more than 10 years at the department. "It was clear," he said, that we were creating more problems through systemic indecision and inaction rather than solving them. Leaning on foreign forces and strongmen, a mainstay of the Cold War, was in the midst of a renaissance. It had been for nearly two decades, since the very first days after September 11, 2001. Some of these relationships were born under George W. Bush's leadership, in a moment of urgency immediately after the attacks. But many were continued and expanded upon over the course of the Obama administration. Ironically, it was Obama's non-interventionist, don't-do-stupid-shit approach to foreign policy that prompted a double-down on these tactics. His was an administration intent on a legacy of low-footprint intervention. And, along with drones, alliances with foreign militaries and militias were at the heart of that legacy. In 2014, he stood at the United States Military Academy in West Point, New York, and described to more than 1,000 graduating cadets, clad in traditional gray, his vision for a new era of American engagement in the world. At the center of that vision was proxy war. Over and over again, he used the word partner, referring to foreign militaries or militias doing the bidding of the United States. Why send American sons and daughters to do work that Yemenis and Pakistanis could be paid to do for us? While the motivations changed from administration to administration, all three presidents since 2001 doubled down on that principle. But these relationships invariably carry with them the acute compromises to human rights and to broader strategic interests that Levine witnessed in the United States' Syria policy. We don't have to speculate about the effects of those compromises. The trend has already proved disastrous for America's trajectory in conflicts the world over. Sidelining diplomacy in favor of direct dealings between our military and local warlords was at the heart of America's declining fortunes in Afghanistan. Similar choices contributed to the unleashing of new terrorist threats in the Horn of Africa. And a policy built around strongmen left us flat-footed when revolution struck Egypt and powerless to stop atrocities thereafter. There were also exceptions, a precious few military-to-military alliances with a more balanced approach integrating diplomatic interests, as was the case with the United States' interventions in Latin America's Cocaine Triangle. That cautionary tale seemed largely lost on the Trump administration as it set about its tilt to military-led foreign policy. But it was inescapable for many diplomats who found their work increasingly overtaken by military alliances, including those who worked in Afghanistan. For some of us, that realization began with a warlord and an unsolved murder. Chapter 18. Dostum. He is telling the truth and discouraging all lies. You can smell a mass grave before you see it. Jennifer Leaning had her knitted scarf, the black and blue and red one she always traveled with, pulled tight around her neck. Her black marmot jacket was too big for her, concealing her slight frame and letting her pass for a man at a distance, a small safeguard on a dangerous mission. She brought a hat, too, but she'd given that to her local interpreter. He was just a kid, maybe 18, and jittery, partly from the cold and partly because he was scared of where they were headed. It was midday and not freezing, as Afghanistan could be in January, but a wind had whipped up. A foul smell carried, the garbage odor of death etched in Leaning's consciousness from her time as a physician in conflict zones from Kosovo to Somalia. It came from no specific direction. It was like the ground was rotten. Leaning, small under a vast gray sky, felt exposed. The desert here was flat, horizon to horizon, no place to hide. She edged forward, cautious, knowing the ground might be mined. The scene was unmistakable. Against the surrounding desert, freshly churned soil stood out, dark and damp and crisscrossed with heavy tire marks. It was dotted with a strange harvest, tufts of black and white and cheerful red. It took Leaning a moment to realize what they were. Turbans, clothes, and between them, flip-flops and prayer beads. She stopped cold. There were fragments of skull. There were pieces of ribcage. Human bones. By her side, another investigator, John Heffernan, took a picture. It was the beginning of 2002 in the remote north of Afghanistan. Leaning and Heffernan had been dispatched by the watchdog group Physicians for Human Rights to investigate the treatment of the prisoners of the New War on Terror. Instead, they had stumbled into a deeper and more dangerous mystery, one which would fuel more than a decade of recrimination, land on the desks of some of the most powerful people in the world, and trigger a cover-up spanning two administrations. The investigators were staring down one of the earliest illustrations of the costs of a strain of post-9/11 foreign policy led not by diplomats, but by soldiers and spies. The unmarked grave was in part the product of American relationships with warlords that filled the void created by the sidelining of diplomats. The consequences were about more than human rights. In Afghanistan, American support for provincial despots would reshape the country, helping to create the conditions for the longest war in American history. The investigators had no idea of any of that as they sought to measure the scale of the grave. War crimes experts are trained not to eyeball body counts from afar, but it was clear that this was a large site, body after body, stretching as wide as a football field. As Heffernan took pictures, Leaning got out her notebook. She carried the black-and-white marbled kind favored by middle school students. The stiff covers made them easy to balance on a knee in the field, and her messy handwriting fit in the wide lines. She didn't have much time for notes. They had only been there 10 minutes when they saw the dust cloud on the horizon, and, emerging from it, the dark vehicles. There were 4 or 5 covered Jeeps or Toyota Land Cruisers, Leaning guessed at a distance, and they were heading their way fast. Leaning and Heffernan scrambled back into their own weather-beaten Toyota. The interpreter looked ashen. Their driver, a grizzled man in his 50s, revved the engine. He, too, had been afraid of this part of the desert. He'd spent the drive there nervously glancing in his side mirrors, scanning the horizon. Now he slammed on his accelerator as the Jeeps gave chase, tailing the investigators as they crossed the barren half-mile back to the provincial capital, Shebergon. They didn't stop until they had put Shebergon behind them, continuing east toward the larger regional hub of Mazar-i-Sharif. Leaning and Heffernan sat in tense silence during the drive. Everyone in the car suspected they'd dodged a bullet, or several. The grave was within visual range of the stronghold of one of the most feared and mythologized warlords in modern Afghan history, a horseback-riding, sword-wielding Uzbek warrior named General Abdul Rashid Dostum. He had been an ally and a traitor to every side in the Cold War. In the months following the September 11 attacks, he was at the heart of the United States' new strategy in Afghanistan. Armed by the Americans and shadowed by special forces, his horseback fighters toppled Taliban strongholds across the country's north. The prisoners the Physicians for Human Rights investigators were tracking had surrendered in Dostum's battles, and the Jeeps had pulled out from behind his gates. 14 years later, I stood in General Dostum's court and stared at his reindeer and tried not to act surprised. The reindeer seemed confused as to why he was there, and I must have seemed confused as to why the reindeer was there. But there he was, at least 200 pounds, one antler broken, thrashing against the rope around his face. I stepped out of the way to avoid getting impaled by an antler. As an attendant struggled to hold on to the other end of the rope, Dostum indicated to the deer with both hands, like Vanna White presenting a Wheel of Fortune prize. He beamed at the deer and then at me, a magnanimous smile that said, "See, I brought a reindeer," as if this was the most normal way in the world to arrive at an interview. I pursed my lips for a moment. He was waiting for a response. "That's a beautiful animal, General," I said. "You choose your words carefully in the courts of warlords, especially when they're flanked by men with M4 carbines slung across their chests. Plus, the antlers." It was August 2016. General Dostum had by then gone from anti-American warlord to American proxy fighter to vice president of Afghanistan. He was a living embodiment of the militarization of American foreign policy. A warlord who had, off the back of collaboration with the Americans, ascended to the very top of the new power structures created in his country by the United States. That night in 2016, we were in the vice presidential palace in Kabul, which was like a cross between a James Bond villain's lair and Liberace's dressing room. Dostum had carpeted the entire place in live grass, and as far as I could tell, wherever one could possibly fit a plant, he had attempted to do so. Hundreds of trees and bushes in mismatched terracotta planters crowded the place. Festooning every branch was a wild array of Christmas tree lights, like someone had cleared out a section of Home Depot. There were the big bulbs that flashed in sequence, and the fake icicles that illuminated in a dripping pattern, and, everywhere, yards of rainbow rope light. You had to push through the foliage and lights to reach the seating area in the center, a dais with a mismatched collection of rattan patio chairs and leatherette Lazy Boy recliners. Vases of fake flowers and Hummel-style porcelain statuettes of horseback soldiers stood on Louis XIV-style end tables. In a wicker cage, a fat chuckar partridge clucked mournfully. There was, of course, a giant tank full of sharks. This was Warlord Sheik. Here is how one journalist described General Dostum. Over 6 feet tall with bulging biceps, a bear of a man with a gruff laugh which, some Uzbeks swear, has on occasion frightened people to death. That reporter, Rashid Ahmed, claimed that shortly before he visited Dostum's stronghold in northern Afghanistan, Dostum tied a soldier who had been caught stealing to the tracks of a Russian tank and drove him around until his body was reduced to a meat slurry, a charge Dostum later denied. But Dostum was also, he reminded me frequently, an animal lover.
When people bring some birds or some sheep or some animals to be slaughtered to eat, I tell them, please, take it away, take it. I don't want to kill this bird, this sheep, or this goat, he said, visibly moved.
General Dostum was not an animal lover in the way you or I might be a cat person or a dog person. He was an animal lover as only a powerful Uzbek warlord could be, with a menagerie of hundreds of deer and horses and game birds. On at least one occasion on each day I spent with him, he would mention a horse or a deer being injured, and his eyes would fill with tears, and his lower lip would jut like a child who had just been told the family hamster went on to a better place.
"It is very rare that I agree to give any interview for a journalist," General Dostum said in Uzbek through an advisor-slash-translator doing his best.
A lot of the Uzbek language is formed in the back of the throat, and Dostum's delivery was particularly deep and throaty. He spoke in a lazy, slightly slurred drawl, like a tape played at half speed.
"I have friends who are saying to do interview, and so far I never agree to," he continued.
His comments to the press had been limited to rare quotes given over the phone, and he'd sat down only with academics and adventurers who'd transcribed his legends into rapt panegyrics.
"You're a good fellow from a friendly country, therefore I agreed to accept you here today," Dostum said, his eyes flicking up and down my person, regarding me with some suspicion.
But I had not come to tell the tale of General Dostum, or at least not in the way General Dostum seemed terrifyingly assured I would. I had come to Dostum's grass-carpeted palace in Kabul to ask about an unmarked grave at the ends of the earth. Originally, Dostum was just Abdul Rashid, one of nine siblings born to Uzbek peasants in the desert plains of Afghanistan's Jawzjan province. The nom de guerre Dostum, literally my friend in Uzbek, came later as he marshaled power as a military commander. His family owned a simple clay-brick home, three rooms, dirt floor, no electricity. Surviving in the desolation of northern Afghanistan was a feat, and Dostum showed particular resilience. He claimed that, as an infant, he was once swept away by a flash flood of melting snow water and clung to a branch and survived, alone in the icy water. A villager eventually spotted his tiny hand above the waves and pulled him out.
"What is this?" Dostum intoned, theatrically channeling his rescuer.
"Oh, it is a hand of some baby."
The villager took him to a nearby mosque and held him upside down against a mud wall until water poured out and he regained consciousness. Other childhood legends speak to a different quiddity, his constant flair for violence, starting with schoolyard scraps.
"I was always fighting with the other kids," he conceded, "and still I am the same person."
He paused, sounding for a moment a little rueful.
"But never in my life I attacked anyone else. When they attacked me, I defended myself."
His favorite pastime, then and since, was the ancestral Central Asian game of buskashi, or goat grabbing, in which 15 horsemen brawl for control of a headless goat corpse they have to maneuver from a pole at one end of the field to a circle of chalk at the other. The game was famously violent and chaotic, with terrified stallions galloping and whinnying as players whipped, punched, and trampled each other. It was not unusual for referees to carry rifles to keep rowdy players in line. Buzkashi required strong horses for a strong man, Dostum explained. Plus, he said, I love horses. I have very good memories of horses.